It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. A group of Marquette University law students and community members conducted a series of restorative justice exercises with incarcerated men at the Racine Correctional Institution in the fall. These restorative justice circles brought the participants together to promote understanding and healing between people who have been harmed and people who have caused harm. It's an alternative or an addition to a more punitive approach to justice. These types of restorative practices are also being used in schools to promote better participation and mental health among students. Right now, we're listening back to our conversation with a former judge who's leading this effort at Marquette. You can send along your thoughts and questions by emailing ideas@WPR.org. Do you have any experience with these types of restorative justice practices? What was it like for you? Do you think we need more programs like this in the justice system? And what aspects of criminal justice in the state would you like to know more about, maybe on a future show? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Trujano is an adjunct professor of law and director of the Andrews Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She's a former chief judge from the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Here's a listen to our conversation. Restorative justice has gotten a fair amount of attention recently, but for those who aren't familiar, can you give us the basics of the concept?
Absolutely. So restorative justice really is a unique way of approaching harm from crime or wrongdoing. The easiest way to sort of discern it is to compare it to the traditional system of justice. And the traditional system is focused on retribution or punishment. But restorative justice focuses on righting the wrong and moving towards healing. What it invites us to do is it helps us to try to hold people who harm directly accountable for its repair. But it also, and a very important, gives survivors a voice so that they can begin to recover and hopefully heal. So restorative justice is really a framework in appropriate instances that can hopefully accomplish both of those.
Now, what caught our eye and had us give you a call this time around was this thing you did at the Racine Correctional Institution with people who are currently incarcerated. Can you talk us through what actually happened?
Sure, absolutely. And I'm excited because it's my first attempt to facilitate circles on my own. So I'd like to start with the fact that Marquette University Law School is not unfamiliar with restorative justice. Mm-hmm. Former Justice Jeanine Geske ran the Restorative Justice Initiative for probably 20 years at Marquette University Law School. And she started out with hosting restorative justice circles at Green Bay Correctional and had been doing that for about 20 years. And back when I was a baby judge, just starting out, I was invited by Justice Geske to participate in a circle. And that participation really transformed my view of restorative justice and how we can move people towards healing. So 20 years later, I'm now in a position to facilitate restorative justice circles at Racine Correctional, not Green Bay. And our first restorative justice circle was in early November. So restorative justice circles are really a structured process based upon and rooted in indigenous practices. We take a lot of our practices when we do circles from our Native American friends who used circles to connect humans together, to have people heal from wrongs. And so it's not a new practice, but it's certainly a positive one. So Rob, what we did was I invited community members and law students who I teach in my clinical program to Racine, and Racine Correctional invited about 18 incarcerated men. And for 3 days, we community build, get to know each other, try to understand each other's backgrounds and histories and why we're there. I also have three what we call surrogate victims, not victims of the men who are in circle, but victims of crime and wrongdoing who tell their story over pretty much a full day during the circle process. One was a victim of a gunshot wound from a youth who had shot him trying to steal his car. Another was a victim of sexual assault, pretty egregious sexual assault, actually twice in her life. And then the third lost her child to a drunk driver. And they tell their stories in such an incredibly passionate way and share their grief and pain, but also share their joy of how they came to heal. And the men and community get an opportunity to listen to their voices. And as I say, in most circles, empathy after they tell their stories is pretty palpable. And that's what we wish for. We want people to understand the ripple effect of harm and crime so that they can empathize with the other, build community, and hopefully move towards healing. And that's what we did.
We're talking about restorative justice with Mary Trigiano with Marquette University's Center, Andrew Center for Restorative Justice, former chief judge from the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about restorative justice, if you've participated in it at some level, join in at 800-642-1234. Mary, I want to talk about the people who have been victimized by crime and were willing to do this. I think no one would blame them if they said, no thanks, I don't want to relive this. I don't want to be talking to people who might have perpetrated similar crimes. Can you talk about why they got involved in this?
Yes, absolutely. So I always say restorative justice is not for everyone, and a survivor needs to be willing to want to share their story. And two of our storytellers, our survivors, have been doing this for many years. In fact, they did it with Justice Geske when she first started doing circles back 20 years ago. And they say that telling their story is very healing for them. It gives them an opportunity to explain, you know, what happened to them or to their loved one. And share with the individuals, the community members, and those who have harmed in much greater detail than you'd ever get to do in the traditional system of justice. One of the survivors says, I've saved countless dollars of therapy doing it this way because I want to bring attention to men who are incarcerated, the significant impact of crime and harm that occurred so that they understand and can empathize with those that they have harmed.
What is the benefit or the hoped for benefit now when that incarcerated person who's been convicted of a crime goes through something like this? What are the hopes that they get out of this down the road?
Yeah, I think when you build community and trust and empathy and even let the men tell their stories of trauma and harm that they endured when they were younger, it in many ways changes you for the better. And I think the hope is that, and some of these men will get out of prison and go on hopefully to live life in the community crime-free, that they have a deeper understanding of the harms that they had committed before they were incarcerated. And then it will deter them from doing further harm or try to help and repair in ways that the community deserves to be repaired after their harm. And so we hope that their lives are changed forever. For those who likely will not be leaving incarceration for any time soon, many of them, I think, have had transformations in terms of better behavior in the institution. Several of them want to start a restorative justice ongoing program for others in the institution so that they can benefit by understanding the harms that they committed. And so there's a ripple effect in that way as well.
People might hear about this, Mary, and say, okay, this sounds nice, maybe for one person at a time. Is there any kind of data? Has this been done enough to have any kind of data on whether restorative justice affects things like recidivism or future committing of crimes?
Yeah. So restorative justice has been around for probably 30 years now. It started in the early 70s, mostly used with youth who are committing crimes, and a lot of studies have been done on that. Many of the studies suggest that there is a reduction in recidivism for those who participate in certain kinds and types of restorative justice. There's a higher satisfaction level for victims and survivors of crime who go through restorative justice processes. And then there's some deeper data and research going on right now to see if there are other benefits to the community of restorative justice like, for instance, does it build stronger communities? Does it, you know, help people stay out of prison so that stronger communities can be built once they return to their home?
We're talking to law professor Mary Trigiano about restorative justice and her work as director of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these ideas as you're hearing them? How should they fit into our criminal justice system? Have you participated in some sort of restorative justice practice program, one of the circles we've talked about, or training? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mary Trigiano, former chief judge for the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. She currently directs the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She's with us today to talk about restorative justice and a recent Marquette Law School project hosting restorative justice circles with incarcerated men at Racine Correctional Institution. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions to this idea, maybe your own experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellie is with us in Brookfield. Or Elle, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
So I was just saying to the other girl that answered the phone that I was incarcerated in the Wisconsin prison system for about a year and a half. And I noticed that y'all were talking about the men's system a lot, which is great. But what about the women? Because I feel like the women get left behind a lot in these kinds of projects.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Mary, have we had restorative justice programs at women's correctional institutions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we certainly don't want to leave anyone behind. Justice Jeanine Geske had been working somewhat with Tachita, trying to get circles there. There are some rules, certainly, that they have at some of the prisons. But we also did and are continuing to work with Project Return to do some circle processes at the Women's Correctional Facility just north of downtown Milwaukee. And they've been doing circles of support there for women for some time now. So we hope to increase our capacity at the Andrews Center to help and support that and use students to actually go in and help facilitate circles there.
Well, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob joins us now in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hi. I was a participant in a program, and I have... This is a huge subject for me. And, you know, what I'll just confirm what your guest said, that the programs are not for everybody. And with the, for instance, the people I did time with, a lot of them would just take a program to reap the benefit of, for instance, getting out early or, you know, to use it to their own ends and not for the learning experience. So the people that I did the program with, I would say there was 12 of us. About 10 of us got through it with coming out with something. So, again, I have a lot more to say on it, but I just wanted to confirm what she had said, that it is true. It is not for everybody.
Well, I want to ask, Rob, since you went through restorative justice, what did you feel like you got out of it?
Oh, geez. Again, we don't have enough time for that, but I'll just say a better understanding, more empathy for the victim, because, you know, because when you go through that part of the of a program, as far as victimization and re-victimization, you feel even smaller and more terrible than you did before. I mean, but they guide you through to get you back to, you know, not feeling so bad about what you did. So again, it was a great program that I went through, and you know, I've taken it. I'm looking to take it a little step further now that I'm out, but again, one thing at a time.
So, okay, I gotta ask, Rob, what would the next step be? Sorry, before I let you go.
Helping others.
Excellent. Rob, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Mary, Rob got a lot out of it, but feels like some people might just game the system with something like this.
Yeah. Congratulations, Rob. And I appreciate you calling in and talking about your experience and having 10 out of 12 really get good experience from it is, you know, to me hopeful. But, you know, I understand that as well. It's a voluntary program at the Racine Correctional. In fact, they put it out there because we could only accommodate about 18 individual men at Racine Correctional. It's my understanding they had about 120 that signed up for it. So we'll be going back each semester to host a new set of men in Circle. And the hope is that, just like with Rob, they get something out of it so that it can transform and change their lives for the better. And it sounds like that's what Rob is going to do. And I think the majority of people ultimately do that as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob, at 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Mineral Point. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on. I just simply want to say thank you for having this conversation. I've come to learn that restorative justice and circles have Aboriginal Native American roots. So I'm wondering to what extent we can speak to maybe the influence the culture has on the processes and its intention, you know, that has been set forth for a very long time. And then in addition to that, I'm hearing a lot of callers, you know, call in and talk about people misusing and taking advantage of the process. But I just want to have folks understand that this is a process that's individualized and is special and unique to each person and each group that's involved. And it's important to be thinking about radical forgiveness, right, as a process for getting beyond and making sure people transform instead of staying stuck in punitive measures and harming people to teach a lesson.
Jeremy, so thanks so much for the call, Jeremy. Mary, we mentioned the indigenous roots of that at the outset of the show. Thanks for reminding me of that, Jeremy. But that idea of forgiveness versus a punitive approach, is that an accurate depiction of restorative justice, Mary?
Yeah, thanks for the call, and you hit the nail on the head. It can be about forgiveness, but it doesn't have to be about forgiveness. I think many of our survivors would say, "I am not going to forgive the person, but I want to have a dialogue with them about the questions about why it happened to me, why, you know, what can you do to help repair that harm? If it leads to forgiveness, that's good, but it doesn't always have to, and it doesn't always lead to forgiveness."
Thanks again for that call, Jeremy, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Trajano with the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. Mary, I want to talk about another venue now. We've been focusing on corrections so far. Schools are looking into restorative justice programs. What kind of things are you seeing out there?
Yeah, great question. In fact, you know, restorative justice can be done in many types of situations. It can be done in businesses, in schools. Wherever there's a harm or wherever there's a wrong or wrongdoing and you want to use a restorative justice process, there's many ways that can be done. But schools have adopted restorative practices for many, many years. And I know when I first began learning about restorative justice about 20 some years ago, the district attorney's office here in Milwaukee was working in Milwaukee Public Schools with others to facilitate restorative justice circles or community conferencing, which is a different form of restorative justice. And so, you know, if you ask the question, who was harmed, what is that harm and the ripple effect of that harm and how can we repair that harm and put it into a school system, it has some unique benefits, just like restorative justice has in the justice system. So grade schools, high schools, I know Marquette University is looking at, like other universities of higher education, using restorative practices in terms of discipline or wrongdoing on campus or disputes amongst individuals. And, you know, it is about having a civil dialogue, which is very difficult for us to have in these times, right? Actually sit in a circle or sit in a community conferencing and have a facilitated civil dialogue with each other that can lead to healing and not more harm doing.
I wanted to ask before we run out of time, Mary, just in our last minute, about training for people facilitating these circles. I've heard anecdotally from some schools, from staff and students that, you know, there's kind of an announcement. We're doing restorative practices, limited training. It went, not surprisingly, poorly. What goes into making somebody ready to be a facilitator?
That's a great question. And I'm still learning from the best, which is Justice Geske and others. I think to be a really true good facilitator of a restorative justice dialogue, you have to certainly stick to best practices, learn from the best, be critiqued, be willing to be critiqued so that you can increase your capacity to do so. Because the last thing we want to do is go in and re-harm somebody or individuals where the focus is to heal from harm that has happened. And so training, being critiqued on how you're doing it, giving it time to grow within you, I think is really, really important to becoming a good facilitator of restorative justice dialogues.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Mary Trajano is an adjunct professor of law and director of the Andrews Center for Restorative Justice at Marquette University. She's also a former chief judge for the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. She talked with us about the idea of restorative justice and how she and her students put it into practice at the Racine Correctional Facility last fall. Reminder that you can listen back to that conversation or share it by visiting WPR.org. And while you're there, you can browse the archives of our programs, read the latest from the WPR News Department, and check out our podcasts. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report finds that households in the United States are paying 25% more for groceries than they did before the pandemic. That's more than what we've seen with general inflation. Our next guest dug into the numbers to uncover the root causes of why food prices have stayed high even as inflation has cooled down. She joins us now to share the findings, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the cost of groceries been a concern for you and your family? Are there particular items you've noticed going up and maybe staying up? Have you made changes to the kinds of meals you eat, the brands you buy to make your food budget work? Do you receive food assistance like SNAP or WIC? If so, has that been enough to keep up with the cost of groceries where you live? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Pancotti is Strategic Advisor for Groundwork Collaborative, where she co-wrote two recent reports looking at corporate profits during inflation and the rise in grocery prices. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think a lot of us have felt the pinch when we're shopping, noticed particular items we regularly buy going up. When you take a broader look at groceries in general, what are some of the key things we're seeing?
So we find that since the start of the pandemic, since the end of 2019, grocery prices overall are up 25%. And as you mentioned before, that is more than overall inflation, which is up 19%. So I think also just given the regularity of grocery prices, you know, most folks are going once, if not more than once a week, people really feel the increase in grocery prices more so than maybe a used car, which you certainly don't purchase every week and may not have even purchased one since the onset of the pandemic. We're certainly noticing that some items are rising faster than others. I think, you know, a year or two ago, folks really pointed to eggs. Those actually have come down a significant amount, almost 25% since last year. And, you know, milk and other kind of staple items are down. But we find that five items drove nearly 30% of grocery inflation over that time period. So beef, poultry, juice and other kind of non-carbonated beverages, fresh produce and snacks, which I think that for a lot of people that makes up kind of the bulk of their cart. But people, I think, are really still feeling those price increases at the grocery store, even though the growth in those prices has slowed over the last year.
Before we dig into the causes of those prices, I want to talk a little bit about the consequences. Now, for somebody at the top end of the income scale, increase in grocery prices, they may not feel it so much. What kind of impact is this having, especially at the lower end, though, of the income scale?
Yeah, it's a really good point. The burden of these higher grocery prices is certainly not borne equally across the income spectrum. So we find that folks in the bottom 20% spend about a quarter of their income on groceries, where those in the top 20% actually spend less than 5% of their income. So we find a much larger impact, obviously, at the bottom. Specifically at the bottom, though, folks at the very bottom are going to receive food assistance or SNAP. Those benefits have increased a lot since the start of the pandemic as a result of some reforms that the Biden administration has made. And so we actually find that on average, the typical family that relies on SNAP has seen their benefits increase at more than double the rate of grocery price inflation. The problem with that, though, is that only about 15% of Americans qualify for those benefits. And so if you fall into kind of the missing middle of folks who are lower income, but not so low income, they qualify for benefits, you are really feeling the squeeze at the checkout counter.
Talking to Liz Pancotti, strategic advisor for Groundwork Collaborative, co-author there of two reports on inflation, the causes of inflation, and especially the price we pay for our groceries. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Liz, the big question is, what is driving these costs? I think the sense during the pandemic and shortly after was supply chain stuff, and that was there, a cost of labor, things like that. What are we seeing now as the grocery food costs seem to be persisting a little higher than inflation in general?
Yeah, so we find a couple of things. One, you're absolutely right that those supply chain snarls were certainly present kind of as we emerged from the pandemic and as folks, you know, bought a lot more groceries there when we were all staying at home. Since then, we found a number of climate-related factors have really affected the supply of kind of key grocery items. So droughts in some places and more rainfall in others have kind of affected meat and sugar and fertilizer markets. The Ukraine-Russia war has also driven up prices for products that those two countries supply to the rest of the world, like oil and wheat and fertilizer that kind of lets all the other stuff grow. And so those shocks, some of them have were temporary or acute, and some have really persisted. In addition to that, we've noticed that even as those shocks have sort of moderated and supply is back at kind of a normal level, companies are still keeping those sticker prices high, even though their input costs have come down. And so we find that in a number of industries, those companies are bragging that their margins are expanding as their costs come down. And though they're not hiking prices anymore, they are leaving prices at those much higher levels, meaning that American families are really subsidizing those companies when they check out at the grocery store.
And that I know that had been floated as a notion over the last couple of years. Some people call it greedflation, but it can be hard to tease out what different factors are leading to particular reasons for price increases. What can you point to say, yeah, this greedflation, this idea that companies have learned that, hey, we're willing to pay more for stuff, so they're going to keep charging more for stuff even as their costs go down. How do we figure out if that's really the factor?
Yeah, so we have another paper, as you mentioned, that we released, I guess, about 2 weeks ago now, where we find that in the most recent quarters that we have data available for, so the second and third quarters of last year, that the percent of price growth that was driven by, you know, labor costs, which have obviously gone up since the pandemic, non-labor costs, which are kind of those inputs like, you know, raw materials and transportation and whatnot, and then corporate profits. We find that corporate profits are driving more than half of that inflation now that those supply chain snarls have really come down. And we noticed this, you know, in, we kind of dug into the earnings calls of a lot of these companies. So in the grocery market in particular, snacks is a really great example. You know, if you're buying chips or Oreos lately, you might have noticed a pretty high increase in those. And we find that those profit margins are up double digits. In fact, for Mondelez International, who makes Oreos, Wheat Thins, and Ritz crackers, we noticed that over a one-year period, their profit margins increased by 75%. And so we do find kind of in the aggregate evidence of that corporate profiteering, but when we dive into particular industries, it's really apparent.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Saner. Hi, Randy. What did you want to tell us about, Randy?
We have a family of four. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And I used to buy organic, wanting to make sure they have, like, good, healthy food. But it was just becoming too expensive with all the bills as well. So we've just gone back to, like, regular items. School lunches consist mostly of peanut butter and jellies and lots of leftover dinners. So we're definitely trying to, you know, budget our weekly shopping trips to like $150 or less.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Liz, Randy and her family not alone. What do we know about how families like Randy's have adjusted to these higher costs of food?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, my household of two is feeling, and I can't imagine a household of four more feeling the squeeze there. My household of two tries to stick to that grocery budget, and it's really difficult, you know, in high-cost areas and across the country. I think to her point about, you know, organic shopping, going back to conventional is one that we are seeing evidence of companies really pointing to a decline in demand for those products just because of prices. A lot of that is just, you know, that those products are more expensive to make and grow. But a lot of it is just prices up on the whole. And so I think her experience is not an unfamiliar one for American families right now.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Liz, another factor you point to in your reports, and this is maybe part of why companies can keep prices up even after their costs go down, is industry concentration. In so many industries in the food world, there might be, you know, 2, 3, or 4 companies selling groceries in an area, processing meat, you name it, the list goes on and on. How big a factor is this?
It's a huge factor. You know, I think meat is one that most people point to and can kind of even tell on their own aisles at their grocery store. You know, 4 companies control between 55 and 85% of the market for beef, poultry, and pork. And we've seen a number of mergers over the last kind of 5 to 10 years in those particular industries that have further consolidated this. This not only raises prices for American consumers at the grocery store, but it really does squeeze the farmers and ranchers that grow and produce that meat. And so I think we're really seeing these big players squeeze, you know, families and small businesses and farmers and ranchers, certainly in Wisconsin. It's a really unfortunate factor. And because they're so large, they have so much power to hike prices because families really have no cheaper competitor to turn to. We noticed this also kind of in the retailer in the actual retailers who are selling this food. And in fact, folks have probably seen in the news a large grocery merger deal between Kroger and Albertsons announced about a year ago, which, if approved by regulators, would really kind of supercharge the consolidation in the grocery retailer industry. And so I think folks are anxiously awaiting the response from the Federal Trade Commission on that particular merger.
Elizabeth Pancotti is an economic policy expert, co-author of a new report from Groundwork Collaborative about inflation and grocery prices. She's with us for a look at what's hot behind higher grocery bills and what policymakers can do about it. We'll get into that in just a few. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a grocery shopper, what kind of things have you seen a sticker shock for over the last couple of years, have you seen some things go back down? And if you work in the food industry supply chain, from farming to stocking those store shelves, love to hear your observations as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with economic policy researcher Elizabeth Pancotti about why food prices have stayed pretty high, along with some policy fixes aimed at reining them in. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How has the cost of food affected you and your household? Are there policy changes you would like to see? Do you have questions for our guest about her reports on these issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, my question is if your guest, your association has knowledge of these horrendous profits that these companies are taking in, what are government oversight measures in being enforced, or if there are any at all? Why are they just allowed to do this without any ramifications?
Daryl, thanks for the call. Liz, you've looked at least some government statements about accusations of price gouging in food. What kind of things are out there?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one, I'll say that, you know, there have been some recent actions taken by the Biden administration to kind of target this price gouging. And so recently there was a price gouging case of chicken meat packers raising prices actually before the pandemic. So a lot of this stuff just unfortunately happens on a lag. More recently, you know, I think the Biden administration has realized that companies really are taking advantage of American families, and we've got to do something about that. And so you can kind of see that in some of their more recent work on junk fees, for example, kind of outside the grocery space, but, you know, in at auto dealers or bank overdraft fees, they really are tackling these places where companies just rip off consumers. In addition, I think, you know, the Biden administration has really targeted competition in the agriculture and food markets. And so one of those ways is in October of 2022, the U.S. Department of Agriculture proposed regulations to kind of rein in deceptive practices and outsized anti-competitive factors in the livestock and meat processing markets that weaken competition. And so those rules, when finalized, would significantly improve the industry for farmers, ranchers, and consumers. Outside of the U.S., you know, you've seen other countries with maybe more authorities on the books really take this on. So, for example, in Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau told grocery retailers that they must come up with a plan to lower prices for Canadian consumers, or their corporate tax rate could go up. In Europe, we've seen actually a large grocery retail chain say to Pepsi, "We're no longer carrying your products because you've decided your prices can skyrocket so much, and we don't think it's fair for consumers or for the retailers' bottom line." I think you might start to see, you know, kind of more action and more public comments from the president on this particular issue. There was a great New York Times article about this over the weekend, where the administration is really taking on kind of public shaming of these companies. But beyond that, there are more limited authorities to, you know, price controls or kind of corporate profit caps, like some other countries have. And so there are fewer resources, but I think the Biden administration is exploring all of their options.
Thanks for that call, Daryl. Barb joins us now in Madison. Barb, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if there is a list somewhere of these quote-unquote greed companies, because I'd actually boycott them.
Barb, thanks for the call. I mean, can we name names that specifically, Liz, that some companies are keeping prices up and making more profits than other competitors?
It's a great point. We actually, at the Groundwork Collaborative, put out a little chart with about 10 of them to show their profit margin increases. And in the full paper, which you can find at groundworkcollaborative.org, we've got quotes from about a dozen different companies' earnings calls where they are bragging about these outsized margins. So it's definitely out there on the internet. And I don't know that we made a boycott list, but you could pull something together.
Thanks for that call, Barb, at 800-642-1234. The tricky thing for Barb, though, Liz, is if there are only, you know, 2 through 4 ultimate providers of a particular line of products, and, you know, maybe they have sub-brand names along the way, and 2 through 4 of those companies are bumping up their prices, you can't really boycott them, right? Because you're just going to their competitors doing the same thing.
It's true. So we actually, in our corporate profiteering paper, we point to the diaper industry, which, you know, I'm not sure parents can boycott diapers. So it's a good consideration. But we find that there are actually 2 companies, Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark, that control 70% of the U.S. diaper market. So Huggies, Pampers, you name it, they're all made by the same 2 companies. Diaper prices have increased by more than 30% since 2019, going up about $6 a pack. Those 2 companies have seen their costs for wood pulp, which is the kind of absorbent factor in a diaper, go down by 25% last year, and yet diaper prices haven't come down at all. In fact, these companies are bragging about windfall profits on their earnings calls. And so I'm not sure that you can boycott diapers because, as you said, there's only 2 competitors, both their prices are high, and not putting your toddler in diapers probably isn't an option for most parents.
Thanks again for that call. Talking to Liz Pancotti, economic policy researcher at the Groundwork Collaborative, looking at inflation, especially when it comes to food prices. Still time for you to join in with your questions or experiences at 800-642-1234. I got a caller who couldn't stay on the line, bringing up another fact here. Tom from Bangkok says, everything that we buy in this country is hauled by trucks, which run on diesel fuel. I think the high cost of diesel fuel is driving a lot of the inflation we're seeing. That is another factor you looked at, Liz, transportation in general. I know there were points in the pandemic or post-pandemic where that was a big factor. How much do you see that playing into food costs?
Yeah, it was definitely a factor when gas and specifically diesel prices were much higher. Those have come down pretty significantly over the past year, though I think there are some concerns about shipping costs going back up, given kind of recent disruption in the Panama and Suez canals, which some folks may have heard about. So I think there, you know, there really are these ebbs and flows. And the big takeaway I think we got from the food report was our supply chains are just, they really lack resiliency. And so the tiniest shock reverberates throughout the entire supply chain, really affecting the price that consumers pay at the grocery store.
I want to look to the future a little bit, Liz. Now, to pick a product I rely on, a breakfast cereal, there's different brands. Prices went up. They've dipped a little. At some point in a market, if the cost went down, a competitive market, Company A would start lowering their price to lure Rob's business over to them, and Company B would have to follow up, and those prices would start settling down. Do we expect to see something like that happening, not just in cereal, but other foods as well?
It's a good question. I would love for my Honey Nut Cheerios to cost a little bit less, though I find the store brand doesn't taste as good. But it's a really good question. And actually, what we've seen over the past few years is the opposite. Because there's so little competition in these markets, you know, Company A sees that Company B is going to keep their prices high. It gives them an excuse to keep their prices high. And because customers really like their breakfast cereals or whatever they're buying at the grocery store, they can keep those prices high. And they're still competitive with their competitors, and people will still buy them. And so, you know, I think those volume dips in sales have not really realized for these companies. And as a result, they have no incentive to lower their prices to a competitive level. I agree with you that in a perfect market, you know, what we're taught in Econ 101, that's what should be happening. But unfortunately, I think these companies are kind of what some economists have dubbed tacitly colluding, or knowing that one company is going to keep them high and it gives them an excuse to keep theirs high as well.
Just briefly, Liz, on the politics of this, you mentioned some action from the Biden administration. This is a huge constituency, presumably everybody eats. Do you see a lot of alarm and action from the political world to tackle this issue?
Yeah, so actually, I just saw this morning that Senator Baldwin retweeted an article about our report. So I definitely think that local policymakers in Wisconsin and across the country, the Biden administration and others, are paying attention to this. It is a hard issue. there is not a magic wand to wave to bring prices down at Kroger or Walmart overnight. It really requires a harder look at the resiliency of our supply chains, the competition in our markets, and ultimately kind of this corporate profiteering that unfortunately our regulatory and tax policies really enable and in some cases incentivize. And so while I think when we set out to write this report, we hoped we would be able to find the crux of these price increases, it's such a pervasive issue from climate factors to increased transportation costs to, you know, global economic conditions. The whole thing, all of this is so interwoven that policymakers unfortunately don't have a magic fix for this. But I think it is something they know and are paying attention to.
Thanks to our guest, Elizabeth Pancotti, economic policy researcher, strategic advisor at the Groundwork Collaborative, with us to talk about why grocery costs have stayed high even as inflation cools. Sometimes when you buy something old and used, you get what you pay for, maybe even end up with a lemon. In an auction in England, a lucky buyer got both. An auctioneer posted an item up for bid last month. The description read, a dried citrus with inscription given by Mr. P. Lou Fancini, November 4th, 1739 to Miss E. Baxter. Yes, it's a lemon or some kind of citrus getting close to 300 years old. Yes, there are pictures. No, you wouldn't want to eat it. Apparently, the auctioneers were getting a cabinet ready for auction when they found the rock-hard piece of dried-out fruit with that inscription. They put it up for bid. The cabinet sold for about $40. The lemon, almost $1,800. It makes me think about Miss E. Baxter and what she thought of the gift of a lemon. Did she cherish it so much she tucked it away as a keepsake? Or was she like, gosh, thanks, lemon, and then hid it away in a cabinet at the first chance? The world may never know. When life gives you lemons, keep them in a cool, dry place. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The pandemic changed the way a lot of people work, and for a lot of people, it changed where they work. With so much disruption, some employers say they've seen an erosion of loyalty. It's a two-way street. Workers might feel like their company doesn't value them enough or treat them well enough. Employers might see workers not trying so hard or switching jobs more frequently. It can be hard to rebuild loyalty if neither side feels like they're getting it from the other. Our next guest has some ideas for where to start and what might have gone wrong. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How loyal do you feel to your workplace? What does loyalty mean for you as an employee? What does it take for you, if you're in the working world, to feel loyal to an employer? What do you need from them? Flip it around. If you employ people, do you feel like people are more or less loyal to you than they used to be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Aki Ito is chief correspondent at Business Insider, covering the workplace and the economy. Her latest piece is called The End of Workplace Loyalty, Why Work Feels So Broken Right Now and How It Can Be Repaired. Aki, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back. And you've written a lot about, you know, what we do on the job, our attitudes toward work. We've talked about a few of them on the show. What led you to tackle this concept of workplace loyalty? What got you interested?
You know, I've just been hearing about it over and over again from readers, you know, whether I'm writing about quiet quitting or job hopping. You know, readers seem to always kind of divide into two groups. The bosses and the managers seem to always complain, like, gosh, like employees these days, like they seem to have no loyalty. Now, on the other side are, you know, kind of younger employees who, you know, seem equally aggrieved. They're saying, you know, why should I be loyal to you when you're not loyal to me? It just seemed like there was this big divide and I wanted to dig deep into it.
And part of that digging was, you know, to see if this was just sort of a vague golden age concept, like back in the day, workers and employers were more loyal. And you dug into it. You see some truth to that for a part of American history.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in the three or so decades after World War II, there was just this, you know, period of, you know, enormous generosity from American companies, from American employers, where they really did share the wealth with their employees. And during that time, you know, they embarked on an extraordinary expansion of benefits like healthcare and pensions for employees. There was this real kind of attitude and, you know, a sense of like obligation to take care of employees. And in return, employees were happy to be loyal to their employers because, you know, they knew they would be taken care of. It made, you know, it made sense for them. It was rational for them to be loyal. But that's obviously not the job market we have anymore.
What changed that?
You know, it seems like, you know, attitudes really started to shift in the 1980s. A lot of it was because of globalization. Japanese companies at the time were, you know, starting to look like a real threat to the competitiveness of American businesses. So a lot of CEOs, kind of the Jack Welch types, you know, sat down and said, like, we can't do this anymore. We can't be so generous to our employees. We have to cut costs. As a result, a lot of benefits went away. A big one was pensions, of course, and employers started to embark on layoffs much more regularly than before. Back in, you know, the 60s, even the 70s, layoffs were really, really rare. But today, of course, they happen all the time.
There was that expectation, I think this is a commonplace now, that, hey, in that era, you're talking about the post-World War II era, you might come back from the war or graduate from high school or maybe college, sign on with a company at the lower rung, maybe work your way up a little bit, retire from that company at the end of the day. That sounds, I think, like a fantasy life to a lot of people now.
Yeah, certainly it doesn't happen now. I mean, you know, it's important to acknowledge that this kind of lifetime employment was, you know, offered only to a select group of the population. So women were shut out of these jobs. You know, workers of color were shut out of these jobs too. For blue collar workers without a college education, you know, they had a little bit more instability as well. But, you know, if you were a college educated white male worker back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, yeah, you could definitely expect that kind of job security. That just seems like a total fantasy today.
Aki Ito is with us from Business Insider, looking at the idea of loyalty in the workplace and lack of same, as she says, her readers who are in management feel like workers aren't loyal in many ways, maybe like they used to be. Employees saying, hey, companies aren't loyal to us. You could join in with your thoughts on either or both sides of that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's take things to the present day now, Aki. What, from the employees' side of things, if they're not feeling loyal to their employer, what might that look like?
So I think, you know, that would probably most benefit, most manifest in job hopping, right? So as soon as, you know, something goes wrong, they're already mass applying to all kinds of jobs, staying at only a single company for a year or two, sometimes only a few months. You know, in the most extreme case, which is was the subject of what I wrote about a few months ago, you know, somebody might even take on multiple full-time jobs, which is usually against the employee agreement at most companies, and, you know, kind of secretly juggle those jobs for not only extra pay, but extra job security.
And then on the other side of things, if an employee is looking at a business and saying, hey, they're not being loyal to me, well, what could that mean?
If an employee is saying, you know, a business isn't loyal to me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think like also, you know, it means that you won't, you know, go above and beyond for your company. The interesting thing for me about this story is like, even though we know intellectually that layoffs are a thing, that, you know, employers stopped being loyal to employees a long time ago, I still think there is this kind of like norm to be loyal to your employer. It feels a little icky, you know, when you're job shopping behind your boss's back. And so, you know, the interesting thing is, like, it's totally rational, I think, for workers to job hop, or maybe sometimes even taking a second or third full-time job secretly. You know, they're just protecting themselves in this current economy. It's, you know, I think a lot of people still feel bad about doing that. Like, it's kind of against the rules in some way. So I find that tension interesting too.
We are talking about loyalty at the workplace, going in both directions, employees to their employers and vice versa. Aki Ito wrote about this at the Business Insider. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had an employer where you thought, you know what, in some ways they're treating me in a good way, even if maybe I'm not paid the most, even if it's not a perfect job, they've earned my loyalty, and I'm going to stick with them as long as I can. Have you ever had the opposite kind of job where you think they've done nothing to deserve my loyalty? I'm out of here the moment I get another offer. If you are an employer, how do you try to generate loyalty among the people who work for you? What does loyalty mean in the workplace setting to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. If you're on the job right now, it's okay. We'll give you an exemption. You can take a few minutes to do that. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Aki Ito. She's a senior correspondent at Business Insider, where she covers the workplace and the economy. She's with us to talk about her latest article on loyalty at work, why both workers and employers feel like they're not getting a lot of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to our callers now. Louisa is with us in Cameron. Louisa, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to say that, you know, I'm in my early 50s, and I've wanted to, and I've been that loyal employee that drove through the snow and kept things going. And but now, I really honestly don't think most bosses care anymore. You know, you have to be kind to your employees. You can't just give them all these arbitrary rules and expect them to do it, you know?
So if you're making suggestions to the next generation, Louisa, so what would you tell them?
Well, I personally tell my daughter that if you don't like a job, you know, talk to your boss. If things don't work out, it's not going to get better. You're just better off to go look for another job, Louisa. You know, and...
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Louisa. Aki, Louisa says, hey, I was the loyal employee, and doesn't sound like she feels like she got a lot out of it. Is that something you hear often from people?
Yeah, absolutely. There was one, you know, organizational psychologist I spoke to for this story who came up with a concept of, it's called the psychological contract. It's, you know, what employees and employers think they owe each other and what they're owed in return. And a really important part of that contract is reciprocity. You know, if you give something back, you kind of expect something similar in return. And I think that's what Louisa was just expressing. You know, she was loyal, but her employer wasn't loyal back. That's a violation of the contract. And so, you know, it's no wonder that she feels, you know, disillusioned about the state of the workplace today.
Louisa, thanks for the call. Mary joins us calling from Iowa. Mary, hello.
Well, hi. Yeah, I'd like to comment or bring up the fact that some of those good old days when the employers were taking better care of the employees was when unions were more more common. And I think that was when the raises in pay and the security in having a job has something to do with the fact that they were union jobs.
Mary, thanks for that call. That's interesting, Aki, because sometimes we think of unions and management as, you know, confrontational, as adversarial. Mary suggesting, that said, maybe those improved benefits kept people together longer.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. Unions were instrumental in negotiating for a lot of these benefits, especially for blue collar workers. you know, back in the day, seasonal layoffs were pretty common for blue collar workers, but it was more standard for them to be called back when times were better, and unions really pushed for that, you know, to call back the same workers that were seasonally laid off before. And they really, you know, pushed for, you know, kind of like minimum wages, even for those workers who were seasonally laid off. So they did a lot. And even the threat of unions, I think, pushed employers to be good to their employees. That was certainly the case for Kodak. They really didn't want their employees to unionize. So that was one of the reasons, actually, that they were so generous to employees.
Mary, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Robert joins us now in Appleton. Hi, Robert. What's on your mind?
Morning. Hi. Just a comment about the loyalty on employees' part. If there's a lack of it, it's due to the employers, first of all, taking away benefits, pay, heightened insurance, and slowly, usually by 1,000 cuts. I'm retired from a company, worked for over 30 years, and I witnessed this, where they have taken away frozen pensions and taken away pensions for future employees, taken away vacations, substandard below inflation raises if you get a raise, increased health, your share of the health costs have increased. It's just it's kind of on them if you understand what I'm saying.
I do. Robert, thanks for the call. Aki, when you talk to employees, maybe people have been in the workforce longer, as Robert had. Is that something you hear them talking about over time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the really important you know, part of what Robert talked about is, you know, he said it happened slowly. It was, you know, through 1,000 cuts, not just one large gash. You know, perhaps that's why, you know, norms have been so slow to change, you know, even though it's been decades since, you know, we had this time when we could expect job security in the workplace. I think the norms have been really slow to change. And I think that's because it's not like one big thing has happened. It's just that these things have changed very slowly, but consistently over time. Sometimes when you have those slow, boring changes, it's harder to write about, right? And so I wonder if that's one of the reasons why I've been hearing so much from readers too, just because this is kind of an old phenomenon, but people seem to really still want to talk about it.
Thanks for that call and for sharing that experience. A newer phenomenon, Aki, since COVID, and this is something you and I have talked about before, is work from home. And now you write in your latest piece that employer maybe may feel more disconnected from that remote employee and maybe treat them worse and with less loyalty and maybe be even more willing than they had been to replace them with a contractor or a temp worker or something like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I'm hearing from employers. You know, it's just when you don't see an employee, you know, in person every day, it's just kind of easier to see them as a number, you know, as an avatar on Slack, as opposed to a real person. And so employers are, there is real data showing that employers are kind of moving away from employing people on a full-time basis and resorting more to contractors, to temps, to freelancers, that kind of thing, to part-time employees. You know, there are some people who like that form of employment, right? It gives them more freedom. But the flip side of that is a lot of other employees who really depend on their employers for benefits like healthcare. So that's definitely one thing to look out for. I think it's a little bit of a kind of a scary phenomenon for a lot of workers.
Talking to Aki Ito with Business Insider, looking at loyalty and lack of same between employers and employees. Back to your calls now. We've got Nick with us in Beloit. Nick, what did you want to bring up?
I think one of the things that I find most interesting about employers and employees and why they are starting to clash is because there's been talk about a four-day work week. And I noticed in some places the bosses have a four-day work week while the employees are still expected to have a five-day work week. So it breeds resentment. Have you noticed this at all?
Oh, interesting, Nick. Aki, is that something you've run into?
You know, yeah, I think like 4-day work weeks. I mean, I would love one, but I think most employers are reluctant to offer it, even though there's a lot of evidence that productivity wouldn't necessarily decline. And I do think that one of the concerns, even if an employer were to offer a 4-day work week, is that you would continue to be expected to work that Friday as well.
And I think also bringing up the point there that if the management is doing something like working 4 days a week or in some other way slacking from the view of their employees, could that breed resentment?
Yes. I don't think I've necessarily heard of that before. If they do, it certainly could. I think we're seeing this more with work from home. A lot of managers seem to be, you know, working from their, I hear from a lot of employees that their CEOs are working from their vacation homes or something, but they aren't allowed to work from outside the office, and they just feel like, you know, they're being held to different rules than management is. So I hear that a lot.
We just have a few minutes left, Aki, and I want to get into some of the solutions you point toward. Are there employers who are trying to tackle this loyalty issue in a creative way to try to bring back, maybe in a different way, that sense of loyalty?
Yes. So I think like the most important thing is that, you know, for employers and employees to come together and really like revise the terms of the contract, you know, to be honest with each other about, you know, what they expect of each other and what they expect in return. You know, one thing I talk about is that employers, for example, they probably can't promise job security in this kind of economy anymore. Or at least like lifetime employment. But, you know, what they probably still can is, you know, to offer employees transparency, to give them a heads up when the business is not doing well, to maybe, you know, offer the opportunity of voluntary buyouts instead of resorting to layoffs the first sign of trouble arises. And then in return, they could ask their employees to, you know, maybe not stick with them for life, but, you know, to give 2 weeks notice, to put in hard work, to be good teammates to their colleagues.
And one thing I had not heard about this, you talked to somebody who studies alumni programs. So, hey, we're a business here, you've left, but that doesn't mean we need to part company. What does that look like?
Yeah, so this is actually apparently pretty common at management consultancies, where it's, you know, they hire like a ton of new grads out of college or business school who stay at the consultancy for maybe just the first 2 or 3 years, and then they usually just leave. That's just kind of like the business model that they have. Very few people stay on to become partners. But then, you know, they'll hold like quarterly networking events or just have like a newsletter for people who've been with the consultancy in the past, even sometimes help them get new jobs. And that way they kind of breed like a lifetime loyalty, like a new kind of loyalty between the employer and the employee. By doing that, you know, I think consultancies do this because they acknowledge that a lot of their former employees end up becoming clients. With other kinds of companies, they might actually hire those old employees back. These are called boomerangs. So I think there is this kind of recognition that you could still have a lifetime relationship between the employer and the employee, even if, you know, they don't, the employer and the employee, like, aren't in this, like, direct employment relationship throughout that time.
Aki, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
That's Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, covering the workplace and the economy. She was with us today to talk about her piece on loyalty in the workplace, lack of loyalty in the workplace, and some ways to try to bring it back. Still time for you to share your perspectives, maybe your experiences as employer or employee. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Mark Zuckerberg and other social media leaders face tough questions from Congress about the safety of children on their platforms. We'll dig into the testimony and some possible changes in regulations and law. And could an American election campaign be done with dignity and respect? We'll meet a nationwide project that's tracking political speech in the 2024 election tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about the idea of restorative justice and find out how it's being put into practice in Racine. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.